This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. What's a college education worth? That's debatable these days, with our changing world making some degrees less valuable or more valuable than expected. But the value of college sports? We know that precisely, like down to the penny, on the balance sheets of sports networks, arenas, colleges, sneaker companies, and in the salaries of America's most renowned coaches. For the players, though, that equation is harder to solve. Yes, there's the cost of their education, paid for in exchange for their athleticism, but now support is growing for compensating these student athletes directly, letting them benefit financially from their hard work. Supporters say paying these athletes is only fair. Critics say this threatens the amateur nature of collegiate sports. The NCAA is moving forward with studying options, though nothing is expected to change in the immediate future. This show originally aired this year after the NCAA announced that it might start developing some form of compensation for college athletes. But how might such a system of compensation work? Should college athletes be paid at all? Joining us from NPR in New York is Tyler Tynes, a staff writer for The Ringer. Tyler, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you. Good to see you. I mean, good to talk to you, man.
Joining us from New Hampshire Public Radio is Luke Bonner, a former college and professional basketball player. He's also the co-founder of the College Athletes Players Association, a nonprofit that advocates for college athletes nationwide. Luke, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us from Oakland, California is Andy Schwartz, an economist at OSKR, a consulting firm that specializes in the sports industry. He's also the co-founder of the Historical Basketball League, the first professional college basketball league. Andy, glad to have you back on the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
We did reach out to the NCAA to invite them on the program. We did not hear back, but that invitation stands. Tyler, let me start with you. Bring us up to speed on what the NCAA announced on Tuesday in a nutshell.
So more or less, the NCAA sort of had this working group where what they were supposed to do was announce a proposal upon which we're going to learn more about compensation for athletes, right? What ended up happening was more of a little bit of a flailing by the NCAA and their working group, where basically they said that they agree with what's going on. What was reported incorrectly was that athletes are going to get paid, which isn't true, and that they're leaning more towards NLI, which is name, image, and likeness for college athletes.
Now, explain what we mean by that, name, image, and likeness. What is that and why does that matter?
The basic premise is that under name, image, and likeness, or under at least the laws proposed by, lobbied for by Ramogi Huma and passed in California under the Fair Pay to Play Act by Nancy Skinner and others, and proposed by even in this state of New York, Kevin Parker in the Senate and others in Pennsylvania, that athletes would be able to be compensated based on their name, image, and likeness by either boosters or by anyone who wants to sort of, you know, put them in a commercial, an advertisement, or at least, you know, compensate them based on the things that they can control.
So if they show up in a video game that EA puts out for the PlayStation, they would get a piece of money, say, every time a copy of that game is sold?
At the absolute best, but even that has complications.
Now, you mentioned the Fair Pay to Play Act. It was signed into law by California's Governor Gavin Newsom last month. It says that colleges cannot punish their athletes for profiting off of endorsements. And Governor Newsom says he hopes that other states will follow suit. You said that put some pressure on the NCAA to kind of make a louder decision to be more affirmative in a position about this?
I think it depends on subjectivity, right? Because I think if you are an optimist, you kind of look at this to say, you know, there was a national groundswell, a political reckoning from California to Pennsylvania across several states, and the NCAA now has to act. I think if you know the history of the NCAA, I think if you've studied kind of how the NCAA's response is, this is sort of another peg in a very long-ranging fight and war against the NCAA for economic equity when it comes to the college athlete, right? And so The issue with the bill in California is that it passed with almost no nay votes, right? 39-0 in one house, I think it was 70-something-0 in the other house, right? And so these bills are non-controversial because the reality of these bills is that they don't actually force the status quo to change in any way. And so that's the issue here, is that the NCAA has merely adopted this rule, made it its own, and can now drag its feet in the same way because California is not enacting any policy until 2023.
Luke Bonner, let's back up a little bit. Give us a sense of what the actual mission of the NCAA is and how this debate fits into that core mission.
Well, that's one of the biggest issues, I think. A lot of times we jump straight to this like pay for play argument. When in reality, I think it's even more simple than that, is that there's really no voice, true voice, representing the best interest of the player in this entire system. You have the NCAA, who's really there, it's made up of athletic directors and university presidents, and their best interest is for what's best for the schools. So it's like they have free rein to do whatever they want. So even the NCAA rules that impact the players' lives and their families' lives the most, that the players get subjected to, they have like no say in what these rules are.
I guess theoretically, Luke, that the athletic directors would be thinking of what's in the best interest of the players as being what's in the best interest of the school, because if you don't have players, you don't have an athletic department. But that's not always the case.
Yeah, I mean, until something kind of really truly happens from either a player movement standpoint or a third party competitor emerging, the status quo for them to maintain it is pretty easy. They improve, you know, an inch with every single like class action lawsuit or this legislative pressure, but that's about the only way you ever see change. I thought it was pretty telling in the NCAA's response. The chair of the board, in his response, he cited as kind of like the two main pieces of progress for student athletes are the NCAA enacting full cost of attendance and guaranteed scholarships for the players. And it's like those things only happened because of, you know, class action lawsuits that the NCAA poured millions of dollars into, you know, fighting against tooth and nail. So it's like they're using those as like wins in progress. But in reality, they've all been a result of, you know, these big settlements that are $100 million settlements and whatnot because of, you know, whatever reason.
Andy Schwartz, can you clear up some of the economics behind college sports for us? When a college makes money from one of its athletic teams, where does that money come from and where does it go?
Sure. So where does the money come from? A big chunk of the money comes from broadcast rights. Sports is one of the most valuable assets that a broadcast network or other form of media distribution, like an online platform, can have. And it's one of the few things that's proved resistant to time shifting, using your DVR, watching it later, because the live action is so important. So sports rights have grown relative to the value of other programming over the last decade and a half or so. There are other things. There's sponsorships. There's endorsements. For colleges, donations probably comprise about 25% of the revenue of a college athletic department. But where does it go? The athletic department spends it on itself for the most part. In a few cases where there has been a state law, something like in Florida or Louisiana, the money has to go in small single seven digits, so $5 million, $6 million, to the university itself. In most cases, it all just gets spent again. And people confuse us. People think that means that the athletic department doesn't make any money. It's really not true. The athletic department makes money, but then it spends money. It's no different than me saying that after I buy a yacht, being an economist doesn't really pay very well.
How much money are we talking about? We got some questions and comments from listeners about just what's really at stake here and how big this is. Kevin wrote on our Facebook page, "Yes, this will only benefit star players in big programs. So what? Big programs with star players are the only ones making money for the university. There really isn't much money for anyone in Division III water polo." Andy, how much money are we talking about?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably right that there's not a tremendous amount of money in D3 water polo, but there might be a D3 water polo player who would like to teach courses in his hometown over the summer. And right now the NCAA rules say he can't tell people why they should take a course from him, a swim class from him, because of his athletic fame. So like literally the reason that you would distinguish him from some run-of-the-mill water polo instructor, the NCAA has taken that away from him. And he's not even getting a scholarship because Division III athletes don't get scholarships. So that's an important thing to remember. But I think it's important to recognize the other thing is that we're talking about athletes' rights. And a lot of this thing gets framed as what privileges will the NCAA allow. But the question of whether I'm worth a little or a lot doesn't mean that you can control whether I get access to the market at all. For a big time Division I player, I suspect we're talking six or even seven figures. Mm-hmm. And so I'm with an organization called the Historical Basketball League, and we fully expect our star athletes to be making in the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. At the low end, it could be the difference between earning minimum wage and earning $30 an hour. And for somebody who's paying their way through school, that's a big deal.
Well, the NCAA has periodically weighed in on the idea of compensating athletes. Here's the organization's president, Mark Memmert, speaking in 2014.
If you're going to hire someone to play football for you, why would you want them to be a student? That doesn't make any sense to me. If they're hired to be an employee of a university, to play football for entertainment, then having to be a student is a distraction that really would sort of get in the way of their being perhaps successful as a football player. Why say you've got to go to school? Why say we got to get you back to class? Why say we're going to constrain the number of the length of a season? Why, I mean, if you're going to make it professional sport, make it professional sport. But there's virtually no one in intercollegiate athletics who thinks that's where it ought to go. So the notion is, are these students? And if they're students, then what are their expectations of them as students? And what are their expectations in terms of the level of support that they can get from a university to be a student?
That's the NCAA's president, Mark Emmert, speaking in 2014. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking about the NCAA's announcement to consider compensating college athletes for the use of their names, images, and likenesses. We're speaking with Tyler Tynes, a staff writer for The Ringer, Luke Bonner, a former college and professional basketball player and the co-founder of the College Athletes Players Association, and Andy Schwartz, an economist at OSKR Consulting Firm and the co-founder of the Historical Basketball League. This conversation originally aired earlier this year. Andy, I'd love your reaction to a tweet from Mark, who writes, "College is for education, and the practice for a game is equivalent to a part-time job, which takes away from time to study and lab. The two aren't exclusive. A little take-home money after expenses is helpful for parents." Andy, the NCAA's position on compensation of various kinds, it's evolved over time, hasn't it?
Only kicking and screaming, but yes. if you listen to what Mark Emmert said in the piece that you played before the break, I think it captures it perfectly, because the NCAA maintains as a legal fiction that the reason that people care about sports, college sports, is that they are true college students. But then Emmert immediately says, look, if we were paying them, we would ditch that completely, because we don't actually think that's true. If I can just contrast that with the Historical Basketball League, we see the conflict that he talks about. There's a conflict between school and work. And so we've moved our season to the summer so that when athletes are being athletes, they can focus full time on their job when they'll be employees of our league. And then during the school year, they'll be in school. But we are not, unlike what Dr. Emmert predicted, ditching the academic piece, because we think that the reason that people like college sports is because they care about the college piece too. They want to see college students playing sports. And I think you can see from Dr. Emmert that from their point of view, the reason that they don't want their players to get paid is because they don't want to give up money. It's not really about education.
I should note again, we did invite the NCAA to take part in this conversation. It did not respond, but that invitation certainly stands. Glad to see some of you lining up on the phones. And we'll get to some of your comments in just a moment. But Luke Bonner, I wanted to ask you about your experiences as well. You grew up, as I understand it, in a family of college athletes. You played college basketball for UMass and West Virginia University. What was life like for you and your siblings as college athletes? I mean, how do people feel about, you know, compensating athletes when you were playing ball?
Well, this whole conversation has come incredibly far since even, you know, when I was in college, which, you know, is a little over 10 years ago now. And you were a college basketball player. Like, if you asked me like what I did, I wouldn't say, oh, I'm a business major at UMass. I would say I'm a basketball player at UMass. It really dominates your life. And so I've been kind of exposed to this since I was in, you know, grade school, really. My brother was an All-American level player at the University of Florida. And we were kind of exposed to a lot of the hypocrisy of the NCAA out the gate. He was a valedictorian of his high school class in Concord, New Hampshire. And he got like a $1,000 scholarship that from the Rotary Club that goes to every valedictorian. Compliance ended up finding out about that at Florida, and he was basically about to be suspended for an entire season, pretty much. And my parents had to pay back $1,000. You know, that's not super easy. My mom's a school teacher. My dad was a letter carrier for the Postal Service. Coming up with $1,000 is stressful. And so I was like seeing this firsthand in middle school. Meanwhile, you look at everything around the sport and it's just wild. So really your entire life is the sport. Even from a value proposition, what you receive, you know, for the services you provide to the university, which is being an athlete, but it's also participating in a variety of marketing initiatives and community events and all this stuff. You're really not receiving the true kind of, I guess, academic value that a normal student gets. Like you're not doing any study abroad semesters. You're not able to work an internship. You have to schedule your classes around your training. That already exists. Your primary purpose already is your sport.
Mm-hmm. Tyler, before we dive in with calls, I want to get into a little bit of the challenge with the details of these plans. Yesterday, Republican Senator Mitt Romney of Utah weighed in on this announcement. He said he supported the idea, but he was a little concerned about the details. Here's what Senator Romney told ESPN's Jeremy Schapp on Outside the Lines.
Look, what you can't have is a couple athletes on campus driving around in Ferraris while everybody else is, you know, basically having a hard time making ends meet. And you can't have a setting where some schools that are in major markets or have big sport followings, some schools are like the honeypot, and everybody, all the great athletes all want to go to those handful of schools. Then you kill collegiate sport. So there needs to be some adjustment to the whole name, image, and likeness approach to make sure that we don't create those problems.
That was Republican Senator Mitt Romney of Utah speaking on ESPN's Outside the Lines. Tyler, what about that? The concerns about the details of how this might roll out.
Okay, so we should probably cut to really the meat of where we are, at least with this issue, right? Is that the reality of this issue is that it has been polled infinitely. There's too much quantitative data that would suggest it has been polled infinitely. Is that the NCAA kind of sits as a shadow group that operates off a basis of racism. And so if our senators and even if our fans believe to a certain extent that what we're talking about is black players. What we're talking about are black athletes, right? At the majority. These are the ones who make the most money in football, in the power sports, and in the power five. They are the money makers of one of the last American plantations that we actually still have and that we feed into. And so
I think some sports fans would have a problem describing athletic departments as plantations.
And that would be their issue. But the reality of the situation.
Well, wait. Tyler, is that a fair comparison to say?
Overwhelmingly fair. Overwhelmingly fair. And it has been fair since we've kind of described it this way, right? The NCAA was built in the end of the 1900s, right? Like around 1908, 1910. It was built for player safety because too many people were dying on football fields in the Northeast. And since then, it has existed for 50 years, really, with no staff and no moral leadership. And so they invented the sanity codes around the 1950s because too many people were actually making money in the same way that they're proposing to do so now. And schools really spoke out about it. And so if you're polling these people at 2014 poll in the Washington Post basically said that if you're asking the average American who they think of as athletes, they think of black athletes as these college athletes. And so if these people are indentured labor, if they are not being paid, if they are throwing their bodies on the line, if every year we have athletes, especially in football, who are mostly black, dying on football fields in practice, this is, without a question, one of the last plantations that we currently exist in the way that labor is being treated. That's not an argument. You can ask almost any academic. It's not an argument. And so the problem becomes this. If our senators don't want these people to get paid, if we're swinging on a pendulum of how we're thinking about racism in our country and it trickles down to our athletics, then that is the issue. The issue isn't just the experience. The issue isn't just how do we do it. The issue is economic equity. If the majority of these athletes at the top level, especially black women and when it comes to women's sports, are propelling these schools forward through athletics, we have to pay them. Because it's not an argument of schematics or machinations or how we get it done. It's an argument of morality and how we have treated the black body in America forever.
Let's dive in on the phones. 855-236-1A1A. In West Virginia, Kevin is on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind?
Hey, Joshua, it's an honor to talk to you.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate you calling in.
I just wanted to respond to something that was asked earlier in the program. You asked one of your guests, where did the money for athletic departments come from? And one of the big revenue streams completely left out, and that's student fees. The vast majority of students at American universities pay exorbitant fees to athletic departments for athletic programs. And that is, you know, there's plenty of programs who spend 90% of their athletic departments fees. And I think that's something that needs to be mentioned and brought up, that and the NCAA will also get some of their funding those streams as well.
Yeah, Kevin, I appreciate you sharing that point. Your line's a little bit shaky, but I do appreciate you making the point about student fees. Thank you very much for calling in about that. Andy, what about that, the role of student fees in this equation?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. That's not the case at the 30 schools that are really driving the economics of the NCAA, but it is true at lower-level schools. A thing I always want to emphasize, though, here is that the issue of student fees, there are plenty of schools that support their athletic departments without using student fees by using tuition money. And that particular distinction, people get outraged about student fees but not about tuition, is a false distinction. If you're writing a single check for the two amounts, it doesn't matter whether I call it all fees or all tuition. With that said, the typical amount of student fees that are being put into funds are essentially funding the non-revenue sports. And I think that's important to recognize too, is that football and basketball take care of themselves at schools like that. There are some exceptions. Rutgers and UConn are pretty famously funding their own football programs. But for the most part, those are funds that are being provided for the sort of things that student fees are appropriate for. Like, we would like to have a field hockey team. And people don't complain about student fees at Division II or Division III schools, but their athletic programs are generally totally funded by it, and the amount is not that different. So I do think it was bad on me to not mention that, but I think it's also important to recognize that generally speaking, the schools that are using student fees are not using student fees to fund this sort of exorbitant football and basketball expenditures that we see.
That's keep going on the line in Atlanta, where Bryce is standing by. Hey, Bryce, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you guys doing this morning?
Good, good. What's on your mind, Bryce?
Yes. I was referencing to as a student athlete myself, I graduated in 2010 down here from Martin Luther King High School. And when I was perceived full ride, they should take care of everything. That was misinformed. When I got to college, I ended up losing my scholarship, which most people, you never touch your financial aid. You never do FAFSA or nothing when you're on full ride scholarship. They take care of everything for you. But going into my third year, I lost my scholarship, and I did my FAFSA myself. And come to find out, my daddy didn't have a job at the time. He had got laid off from truck driving, and my mom was the only one working in the house, which was a teacher. They took my Pell Grant. And what they said they did with my Pell Grant was they subsidized a part of my scholarship, which I was supposed to be on full ride, to help other student athletes get full ride, which doesn't make sense to me, because if I'm on full ride, why would you take money that the government gives you to go to school because you have financial differences in your family, and you still take that and don't give that to the student athlete?
Yeah.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about that before and talk about that in particular, because to me, that makes no sense when you're talking about billion-dollar company. Because the NCAA is a billion-dollar company. They can say it's not a company or whatnot, but they have million of employees, and it's a billion-dollar company. And as a student athlete, you're an employee. You got a set schedule. You got to go to study hall. Mm-hmm. You got to go to bed and get up and work out in the morning at 5 a.m. and still go to school.
Right.
So I did more work in college than I do now at running my own business. And to me, that is asinine.
Yeah, Bryce,
And for people not to know that people take their schools are taking the kids' Pell Grant, and most people don't know. They just think I'm on full ride, the school's taking care of it,
right,
but they're
right.
Not really.
Right.
Not when some people get $10,000 to $12,000 a semester. Okay,
Bryce, I'm glad you shared your story. Thanks very much. And I'd love for you to react to what we heard from Bryce, some of the unexpected consequences that student athletes can run into economically if their circumstances change.
I think a lot of what he's talking about is especially at the Division I level, when it comes to the moneymaker sports, when it comes to football and basketball, is very much the average experience, right? Is that you have Shabazz Napier, who won a national championship at UConn, who said that he was having struggle, you know, who's struggling to eat. If you know Ramogi Huma's story, who was somebody who helped lobby for Nancy Skinner in the California bill, his roommate or his friend on the UCLA football team got suspended for 2 games because he received groceries from the NCAA. And so this is the thing. If we've kind of built, if the NCAA has really built this idea that, you know, athletes and college athletes are not laborers, they're not employees of the school, they're not employees of the NCAA, and their merit is based on their education and amateurism, we have based the entirety of our college athletic experience on a lie. We as Americans and we as people who participate in the fandom of these sports have really knelt at the altar of college sports. And that intrinsically is the problem, because you can't not only change public opinion, you also can't change the NCAA's rulings. And so if the average experience, or at least several of the experiences of several athletes, especially black athletes, have gone through this, where they can't eat, where they can't receive groceries, where they can't receive clothes, where they have to basically work a full schedule, it's insane. And it shouldn't be the norm for our athletes to go through this. They should be paid. I mean, Ramogi Huma in Drexel University in 2011 put out a study where basically they said that the average market value for a college football player at the Division I level is $230,000. And the average market value of a blue chip basketball player is $1 million. That's the average of what these people are worth. And so that's really the thing here, is that NLI is great. Or NIL, I'm sorry, is great.
Name, image, and likeness. Right.
But the problem is that it puts the onus on these athletes to find their own revenue, when the reality should be they should be being given boatloads, truckloads, Brinks trucks of money, because it's the minimum of what they deserve.
Well, Luke, with regards to that money, to the money aspect in terms of the money around, David from Nashville shared some thoughts with that. Here's what our listener David left us using our app, 1A Vox Pop.
We're asking the wrong question about college athletics. These student athletes are already being paid a great deal, if anybody has bothered to look at the price of a college education these days. Perhaps a better question would be, should these athletic departments, who are making millions off these athletes, be funneling that money back into the general fund so that other students would be paying less tuition?
David, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Luke, I wonder what your reaction is to that.
Yeah, I definitely have a reaction to that. I just want to, even what Bryce said, I just want to acknowledge that what he just gave us as a story is exceedingly common at the Division I level. A couple things he referenced there that I just think might be compelling to listeners as well. Athletic departments, even at the Division I level, regularly rely on Pell Grants to put cash in their players' pockets. And, you know, that's like federal funding. That's not intended for athletic departments, but it's a crutch frequently used.
Is that legal?
If they qualify, yeah, you get the money. Another thing is, like, I mean, this is like reality. Is there are, I know of, you know, instances where high level Division I universities, when the school's out of session, the players have to stay on campus during the winter and season, where some of the players, you know, qualify for food stamps, and the schools will like put the players on food stamps to cover, to give them additional funding to have food and stuff like that. So essentially you're taking these players who are worth, the $1 million or whatever that was just referenced, and you're using like basically tax money, right, to help feed them. Beyond that, I forget his name, the second caller,
David,
referenced the value of the education. That's kind of arbitrary, right? It's not real money. It's a ticket. The schools pay themselves basically what the cost of tuition is. That's like saying, like, if you work at like an office that's worth $2 million, like, because you have a cool office, like, that is part of your compensation package. It just doesn't add up.
We're going to continue this conversation and get to more of your calls in just 1 minute. Stay close.
outside, it's like showbiz.
Back now to our conversation with Tyler Tynes, Luke Bonner, and Andy Schwartz. Before we get to some more comments, Luke, I just wanted to close the loop on what David was saying in terms of the costs of college with regards to kind of the college paying itself, that some of the costs are arbitrary, if I heard you right. Some of those costs are rather fixed and they're clear. You've got faculty salaries, textbooks that students have to buy. You know, those of us who went to college not on an athletic scholarship and went to high-power athletic schools, I went to the University of Miami, know exactly what it costs. And I think, you know, the Joshua Johnson of, what is it, how many years ago did I graduate? In 2002? Of some years ago, would really appreciate it if the University of Miami didn't cost quite so much, because I went out with Sally Mae once, and she only stopped calling me last month.
I mean, it's a fair point. That gets to the larger issue, right, of like the college system as a whole. But I guess what I'm saying is that saying that value is, you know, is a equivalent to like basically that value in payment, it's just not true, because you're not getting the full, you know, value of that scholarship in terms of your academic experience. It's widely referenced, you know, that you. Many athletes are forced to change majors, right, to be able to fit their training schedules and their game schedules. You know, you're missing ton of class traveling throughout the year for games and training and all that stuff. So to say that, like, that ticket price is, you know, enough, first of all, none of us, like, I don't think any, like, kind of outsider has the right to say that. But it's also kind of, it is somewhat arbitrary, in my opinion.
Kristen wrote on our Facebook page, as a longtime professor at a private college, I've been fed up for years with being asked to accommodate college athletes. In my classes, attendance is crucial for scaffolding the knowledge they need to process their own ideas. And if they are not there, they miss out. It is not my job to accommodate them. Perhaps if it were their job instead and they worked in the summer, as I just heard mentioned, things would be different. Let's continue on the phones in Georgia, where Dion is on the line. Hey, Dion, what's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for having me. I wrestled in college, so I know my sport didn't make mad money like football or basketball, or heck, even our tennis team, I think, made more than we did. But simple matter of the fact is I was sitting with my car broken down for 3 weeks trying to decide, should I spend the $100 my mom could afford to give me, because I had a half scholarship, so I still had to take loans out, and she was paying back. Do I spend the $100 she can send me once a month to go get groceries or to fix my car? And I remember just sitting there having to make this decision and having to fix my car so that I can go to the next wrestling tournament, because we didn't have the funds. And it would help if I'm not even saying like a full, like, hey, let's make sure you get paid buku amount of money. It's wrestling. We don't get paid. We don't advertise as heavy as football or basketball. But hey, a stipend would be nice for these collegiate athletes, because again, how the previous caller had said, you know, we get these scholarships and they're like, okay, we're getting a little bit of money back here or there. You know, I could be able to survive for a few months or, you know, whatever. And you get nothing. And the minute you get a little bit of something from some other source, you get benched, you get hit with a fine, you know, you get yelled at, because right. You're trying to live and make sure you're in top fit shape for them.
Now, Dion,
and
I
want to try and give that back.
Yeah, Dion, I hate to cut you short. We're having some glitches with the phone line, so I know I got to wrap with you in a second. It's not on your end. I think it's on ours. But I did want to just follow up on what you said. I think to some people, the college education is not only valuable for its own sake because it allows you to earn more in the future, but you kind of go into the college experience knowing economically what it looks like. You know how much it's going to cost. You have a sense of what you can pay. You have a chance to budget for that. You know, the idea of a starving college student isn't fun when you are one, but you do have a sense of what the economics are going in. So your decision to wrestle was great, I'm sure, for you. But economically, I think there's an argument to be made that it's on the student to think through that financial burden before they get involved in a sport that doesn't really compensate.
Yeah, that's true. But still, we're looking at, I know football players who I've known and been like, hey, dude, I've got ramen at my house, because they couldn't afford to get ramen. Hmm. Like, it's more than that. There are sports that make billions of dollars from the NCAA through jerseys, through ticket sales, because they do get a portion of ticket sales. They get it through all these weird loopholes of getting money, but because the guy that wears the number 8 jersey, he can't make any money off of that. Therefore, he's got to starve. Like, that's the thing, is it doesn't make sense to me in that sense. Like, why can't we put some form of a stipend out so that way these athletes can survive? Like, the NCAA makes enough money. Why can't they push that money out and make sure the athletes are properly taken care of? That's what they're supposedly supposed to do.
Right. Deion, I really appreciate you sharing your story, man. Thanks very much. Luke, with regards to Deion's story, I don't think I asked you this before, but what is your best case scenario in terms of college athletics? What do you think ideally not only should be done, but also who should be the one driving this change? Should it be Congress? Should it be some third party? Should it be the networks? Should it be collective bargaining? Like, paint me your ideal solution scenario.
So to me, there are two potential solutions, right? As much as I want to like pump my fist and celebrate some of the legislation that's being passed at the state level, it also makes me like a little bit nervous, because essentially what we have right now is we have elected officials effectively serving as like the collective bargaining unit for college athletes, which, like, no offense to, you know, our politicians and whatnot, but they're not necessarily the most in touch with the needs of the athlete, as evidenced by Mitt Romney's statements yesterday after being kind of celebrated for his initial, you know, willingness to speak out on this issue. So to me, there's two ways about this. One, the first was collectively bargaining. So we attempted the unionization route with the Northwestern football team back in 2014. That kind of, you know, it worked out initially, then it got punted down the road, and it's just not looking very promising now. So if without in the absence of like a collective bargaining unit for the players, I think there might be an opportunity for like a third party competitor to come in and disrupt the space, such as the Historical Basketball League, which Andy, you know, has referenced. At the same time, it's like, if there's going to be a collective bargaining unit, the term student athlete it's a made up term, right? It was invented to prevent the NCAA from having to pay workers' comp for a football player that died back in the day. So, you know, where the unionization effort runs into trouble when you get into legal definitions of employee-manager relationships, I also feel like, can't we make up a term for a union, right? So there is some entity that truly represents the best interest of the athlete. And the other way the NCAA thrives is, as our caller just referenced, I was really impressed to hear from him as a wrestler, vouching for the football player. But one of the ways that it thrives is that it kind of groups all of the sports and all of the divisions together to make it seem impossible to tackle this issue, right? Because it's like you have this internal conflict between the fencer and the star football player. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to treat them all as the exact same thing, reality is they're not.
David wrote on our Facebook page, as an alum of a varsity team of a Division III school, I recognize that college sports have value for the students. However, it is time to recognize Division I football and basketball teams for what they are, money-making minor league teams that are the farm system for the NFL and the NBA. Tax the teams as businesses owned by the colleges, eliminate eligibility and recruiting restrictions, and pay the players. If players happen to be accepted by the school as students, go ahead and give them scholarships, but enrollment should not be a requirement. Interesting solution from David. We also got an idea from Charles, who emailed, one solution I see to this issue is taking the money out of college sports. Why not propose that a public nonprofit institution like our nation's colleges be only allowed to bid out broadcasting rights to nonprofit public broadcasters? Tyler, that's an interesting idea. As a public broadcaster, I think it's bad, because there is too much that goes into producing sports, A, and B, I don't want to hear members of your local NPR member station complaining that we've got too much coverage of the Pac-12 championship and we're not covering the vote on the House on the impeachment inquiry. I think, like, in some ways, the commercial system for what college sports have turned into, for better or worse, it might make the most sense just for the way it's structured right now.
So I think we kind of have to unpack a few of these things, right? Like, there's a fundamental misunderstanding for what these athletes do and how they should be compensated, right? Josh, to push back on one thing that you said earlier, I played Division III college sports, right? And I was considering playing Division I college sports. And so athletes at the time when they're 17 years old, to have them consider the economic values or the economic range of which they have to kind of put themselves into is extremely unfair. And so the reality of this is that we should just find a way to pay the kids. It doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be this crazy made-up system. It doesn't have to be through nonprofits. The money is widely available. It is widely available at almost every Division I college, especially if they have a power, if they're in a Power 5 system. The money is there. The NCAA makes $1 billion off of just March Madness alone. They're not making revenue too many other places. And so it's individually a lot of colleges that have the cash. And then it's the NCAA as the overarching group that has the cash. It doesn't have to be an Olympic system. It doesn't have to be NIL. It doesn't have to be anything that we're making up through progressive policy to find a way to pay these kids in piecemeal ways. We just have to pay the kids, and we have the money. And so the reality of this is that it's not difficult. In the state senate of New York, Kevin Parker, a senator there, is proposing a 15% revenue split between the athletic departments and between the athletes. That's not enough, right? If you can have a caller from Georgia who's a wrestler talk about what he has to go through just to eat, that's a problem, right? And it's at the Division I level to the Division III level. Overwhelmingly, how we are treating these athletes. And when we're talking about the people who are making the most money are Black athletes. And if we're talking about the women who have to struggle through Title IX just to have equity to get on the field, we have a full classification of the entire system being faulty.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about Title IX. Tyler, pause for just one second. Let me read one comment, and then I'll come right back to you on Title IX. Peter emailed, "I've worked for Vanderbilt University for many years. We supported women's basketball. I can assure you that most women athletes valued their athletic scholarships highly. Many could have never afforded an education at an institution like Vanderbilt. Many went on to medical schools and other professional schools that afforded them careers they might not have had otherwise." So, Tyler, with regard to women's sports, the gender pay gap in sports has always been a hot button issue, has become a hotter button issue this year, fortunately, thank goodness. How does that aspect of this factor into the conversation about compensation?
It should be one of the leading parts of this conversation, and the reality is that it's not, because, again, if you're looking at the way that we've been polling our Americans of who they believe athletes are, they think mostly that our athletes at Division I level are Black men. And so the reality of that is that it's not. Now, by large parts and by large percentages, yes, at the Division I level, a lot of the people who are playing in our moneyed sports are Black people. But you can't have, on the inverse, a conversation about gender pay gaps, not only at the coaching level, when you get to women's basketball especially. You can't have somebody who might be one of the best women's coaches in the land, Dawn Staley at South Carolina, who won a national championship in 2017, not make anywhere near as much money as Gina Auriemma, who's in her same sport. And so if we are going to pay these athletes, which we should pay these athletes, there should be a very, very, very large focus on how we are also going to pay the women who are in our sports and the women who are propelling our sports, and especially when it comes to basketball, the Black women who are making our sport so popular and so fun to watch.
One quick comment with regard to race and college athletics. Leah tweeted, "I would like to see the players of color play for HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, and other colleges and universities that represent their own cultures and or hometowns, so that the revenues generated will benefit a wider and deeper group of people." I think we have time to squeeze in one more call. Patrick in New Jersey is on the line. Patrick, what's on the line? What's on your mind?
Hey, first off, I'd like to say that your co-host there, Tyler, has got it all wrong, as in playing the racial card. You know, I was an athlete for a soccer team, and I think everybody's missing the point of being a group. I loved being part of a team, whether they were Black, white, Hispanic, etc. I still keep in touch with all these people to this day. So we're missing that point. In regards to the payment, my payment was a full scholarship. So I look at it this way. I got through school, got a degree, didn't have to have a loan of, say, $300,000 afterwards, and now I'm successful and moving forward. So that in and of itself is a payment.
Patrick, I appreciate you calling in. Although, Tyler, I think the point you were making was not just about racial inequity within the team, but that because there is a racial legacy of the way that Black players have been treated, that compensating the player, not compensating the players, seems crazy considering what players of color have been through historically. I do want to give Luke an opportunity to chime in as we're winding down. You were a college basketball player. You also played professionally overseas, I believe, in Hungary and Lithuania. Looking back on your time as a college basketball player, do you think it was worth it?
I do think it was worth it. And that's a common misconception, is like, just because I'm challenging the system to make it better for the players doesn't mean that I don't love it, right? When you love something, you want it to be the best form it can possibly be. And so that's part of why I feel like I've been fortunate to be in a position where I'm kind of a loudmouth and willing to speak up on these issues. And, you know, I'm okay with the backlash, so to speak. So I think it was definitely worth it. That said, like, I do think I wasted a lot of time on basketball, particularly in college. When I stopped playing professional basketball, I was about 27 years old. I had decent jobs in Europe, not life-changing money or anything, but I had no professional experience and had to enter into the workforce without any idea what jobs are out there. And basically, I was a 27-year-old intern at an advertising agency coming out of it. And I had a master's degree in my back pocket as well. I was definitely delayed kind of my start to real life, I guess.
Right.
But back to what that caller said, too, I mean, in terms of the racial inequities, too, look at the makeup of the players versus the makeup of the coaches and administrators.
Yeah.
It's pretty telling.
Luke Bonner, co-founder of the College Athletes Players Association. Luke, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Tyler Tynes, a staff writer for The Ringer. Tyler, thank you.
Thank you.
And Andy Schwartz, an economist at OSKR and co-founder of the Historical Basketball League. Thank you, Andy. This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.